You want me to start now, Carol?
Session five. Airport presentation and airport strategy. Mr. Glasscock?
Thank you, Carol. About 5 years ago, the airport went through kind of a transformation. We lost our service from American, and since that time, we went up and down with ridership. Right now, we're very successful. We've outgrown basically our facilities out there in terms of parking and terminal needs, and the TSA continues to want more and more. Today, I have Andrew Schneider, the airport manager, with me, and he's going to present some of the history or status of the airport. Andrew?
Thanks, John. Glad to be here. I got about 15 slides. I'll kind of jump through them and then try to leave more time for any questions you might have specifically. So kind of want to just go on three main topics, first being airport infrastructure, where we're at with the terminal building, and then talk a little bit about air service at the end. Airport infrastructure, it's not sexy, it's not glass windows and a new terminal, but it is very important. We've got a five-year contract that we just got with Burns and McDonnell. That'll help us keep our projects running faster and more smoothly, as well as it keeps it all under one roof. As far as many of our projects are very closely connected to each other, so it's kind of an efficiency there that we got. We just council just passed that not too long ago. The other thing, we've got 100% support of the Federal Aviation Administration. They're providing most of the funding for the projects on a 95% federal, 5% local match. They're very supportive of us right now and looking to hand us out money as fast as we can use it, basically. The five-year schedule, we're showing between $35 and $40 million worth of work. That is dependent on some environmental assessment things as well as coming up with a local share, obviously, but that's what we do have slated for right now. That'll include two runway extensions, two full-length taxiway reconstructions, and again, there's the cost. Here's a map showing kind of where we're at. You can see the red color, might be kind of hard to see because we're far away, but the red color is failing pavement. So you can see our Crosswind runway is at failure, as well as our primary taxiway for the airline is also at failure. So those are projects that are on the front burner right now, and so we'll be getting to those, as well as some of the other pavements are starting to age as well. The airport terminal. The terminal was built in 1969. You're probably all very familiar with it. It's a good structure. It's solid. We put a new roof on it. But it is, as John mentioned, lacking room right now. TSA has expanded. As well, when we're putting 50 people on a CRJ, our hold rooms are very cramped. And so there's some things that we've looked at that we can do to expand the terminal and fix some of the issues we have. We've got some ADA issues. The restaurant being upstairs is one, and airport admin is another. Unfortunately, funding is not the highest priority. In the FAA, their funding priority typically deals with safety first and then capacity. And so the safety and capacity is typically going to be all your airfield projects, your pavement, safety areas, and then down the line we get to the terminal. And so until we get all of the projects done on the air side of the fence, we're not a good recipient of funds for the terminal. So that will be down the road. But luckily we have a building that we've looked at. We can do some modifications to it if we need to expand and grow, and I believe that's coming up. These are some of the concepts that we had. RSNH gave us a comprehensive study that we did with them. The top picture shows a expansion to the north as option A, and option B would be a larger expansion that we would do in two phases to the south. Both would work. They both have pros and cons to them as well as price differences. Most in favor have said to the south. As well, it works good on our air side, which lines up, both line up with the apron, so we don't have to do too much for concrete on the other side, as well with our parking lot on the existing. The biggest topic, I think, and what everybody wants to hear about is air service. So kind of just how did we get here? You can see from the dates, we've had Ozark, we've had American, we've had Air Midwest, Mesaba, which is now Delta, that's where we're at. So that has a couple issues with it. People see carriers come and go, and you can start to lose their loyalty towards them. Where we're at right now, we've got regional jet service into Memphis three times daily. And that has been a huge success for Columbia. This aircraft is a 50-seat RJ. Our catchment area is shown on this map. It's typically about 40 to 60 miles, more of the 60-mile radius if you're going north and south, east and west. Obviously, as you encroach towards the Kansas City and St. Louis markets, we realize that we're not going to capture those passengers. Moberly, I have a couple different statistics. Kind of shows the percentage that of the catchment area that actually use Columbia. And these numbers are obviously something we want to work on to catch our local traffic. 2% out of Moberly use the airport. Out of Columbia, we capture about 8%, with an average right around 7% in our catchment area. Emplanements. Our emplanements, obviously, with Delta have seen a huge increase. March of this year, we were 3,314. Most recently, May, we were 3,435 passengers. That is the second highest month we've had in just over a decade. So those are some great numbers. May, that 3,435, that's an 80% load factor, which is a very high number. Usually at that number, the airlines will start changing flight schedules around, adding larger aircraft, things of that nature. So we're working closely with Delta on their expansion, with what they want to do. However, they've stated they want to wait for the summer to get through the summer, and obviously they're dealing with fuel prices and that, so we'll be working with them in the future. So lastly, the last slide basically is what are our options from here? We've got Memphis. We've kind of seen the St. Louis and Kansas City before. That's probably not something that we want to go back to. We've got Minneapolis, Milwaukee, Chicago, Detroit, Atlanta, Memphis, Dallas, Denver, and Salt Lake City. Each of those have pros and cons to them. And so I think those are the hubs that we'll want to look at in the future. And that's probably where we'll see our expansion. At that, I guess I want to give enough time for any questions.
I'll make a couple comments. There's a report that MoDOT did in November of 2009. I have it. I think it's, you can probably get it off the website. But it's about air service outside the metropolitan areas in the state of Missouri. It's really kind of an enlightening report. It focuses on not just Columbia, but Springfield, Cape Girardeau, Kirksville, other towns, but the area, the section on Columbia is interesting because it does talk about that 650,000 employments from 60 miles around Columbia, and we're doing 3,500, 35,000, 40,000 somewhere like that. Yeah, but anyway, our market share is 6-7%, something like that. So there is a lot of pent-up demand. I think the lessons that I interpret from the 2000s, when we had turboprop service into St. Louis and Kansas City, are that, number one, people really don't care too much about that. I mean, that declined in use, it stair-stepped on down until it basically went away for a couple of months in 2008, that the turboprops are considered unreliable because they don't fly in any kind of bad weather. Anybody that had a bad experience, missing a plane, missing a late connection, they're poisoned for 10 years. I mean, they're just not even going to take a chance. They'll take a car and drive it. And the availability of the reliability of these commercial jets is so much greater that the demand has just really exploded on up. I mean, it's been really remarkable, the rebound since 2009, 2010, particularly when the jets came in. So my interpretation of this is that there is an enormous demand that has not been tapped, and that this is a great service into Memphis, and that if we can extend that into other markets, and I really exclude St. Louis and Kansas City. There was a time that St. Louis was a TWA hub. You could have nonstop anywhere in the world, basically, from St. Louis on TWA. St. Louis doesn't have that anymore. You're going to have connecting flights from a lot of destinations from St. Louis, which is why the Memphis route has really worked out well. It's frankly convenient. It's very convenient. When you look at where people go who fly out of Columbia into Memphis, they're going to the East Coast, they're going south, and they're going southeast. They're not going west. Connections are not terrible, but they're just not. And that's why for a lot of us looking at Dallas-Fort Worth, American Eagle flies into Manhattan, Kansas, right? Looking at Dallas-Fort Worth and Chicago O'Hare are attractive options for us. And I think if we can pull that off, we're going to see a substantial increase in demand. I think it's just tremendously untapped. I think we're seeing the university very engaged in this because they have the same issues we do. They got to recruit professors, students. You know, they want it easy for people to get in and out of Columbia, too. And I think they're engaged, and they'll help us. We haven't been able to work with Jeff City very much. I think we need to. 5% market share out of Jeff City, and a lot of flights out of Jeff City for the government and for the industries down there. So I think there's a lot of room for optimism, and I think that one question I have right now, we've talked about this, 250 passenger jets on, you can jerry-rig up something.
We will make it work, sir. Yes, sir. Right. We have a plan to make it work.
Can you handle a 100 passenger jet? That's the same thing, right? The same configuration?
You could handle one, same configuration, but The key out of all of it is going to a hub airport. I mean, we struggled for years going to St. Louis after they were not a hub.
Well, it's actually even more than that. It's having cross ticketing with they call it the global network carrier. I mean, you got to be able to buy a ticket from Columbia to Barcelona, and that's why the Ozark experiment didn't work because it flew in the Midway, right? You got to take a 45-minute cab drive to O'Hare. It flew into Dallas
Love,
which again was a cab drive. You know, if we could get Ozark to start up tomorrow, and we could get them into Dallas-Fort Worth, and if we could get them into Midway, I think they would be extremely successful. And I think that I think we're moving on a commitment to open up those domestic hubs, because they are international hubs too.
So I guess my question is, if Delta is waiting till the end of the summer to see if we maintain our 80%, is that what they're doing? And then once they do, then they're just looking at increasing service to Memphis, or are we exploring do we talk with other airlines in terms of providing service to other locations, or is it just Delta that we deal with?
Well, you're right that Delta does want to wait. We were Essential Air Service up until about September of last year. And so Delta's, after they dropped the Essential Air Service subsidy, basically they became an at-risk airline. And so they felt the market was strong enough that they would stay here and provide the service without any subsidy. And so basically they're still in their first year of not having a subsidy. And so I think that's kind of where they get their basis of saying, we just want to wait, get through our first year, see how the loads are, see how the summer goes. We work with Ron McNeil at Mead & Hunt. He's kind of our link to the airlines, and so we've talked to him about the options of what we can do. Delta has good access to Detroit, which also has a good international market. They could expand into Memphis. Atlanta is hard to get into because they're so busy and so packed that the slots into Atlanta become hard to get as well. They're starting to kind of you're seeing the slowdown of the 50-seat passenger jets into that market, and so there's several things at work. But I think there's a positive feel from Delta because they are doing so well. Inside of Delta, they're saying this Columbia was a success for them. The numbers are up, so that's a good thing. As well, we can always go to another carrier and attract new service, as well as working with and maintaining Delta.
So. Let me add a couple of thoughts on it. The one thing I worry about with Delta is they inherited Memphis from Northwest during their merger. And, well, you know, American inherited St. Louis from TWA, and look what happened. So we are at risk to Delta downsizing their Memphis operation. And they'll make that decision independent of how well Columbia is doing. So, and we know that the chaos that the airline industry is in, they've historically been unable to control their labor costs, which they are doing now, but they're also not able to control their fuel costs. It's just been a very difficult industry. So Delta is dealing with that right now. And secondly, when you look at the history of these regional providers through the 2000s, the ones that just went away, I mean, it's a tough business. There are fewer regional jets out there. They're putting them out in the desert. They're cutting back. I mean, we're wanting to expand service. We're swimming against the tide because these global network carriers are cutting back regional jet service to smaller communities. So that's a major challenge for us, and it may require revenue guarantees to get that kind of service into more airports from Columbia. Again, I'm optimistic that the demand is very robust, and if we provide the service, they will come.
To comment on your statement, if we would have two carriers, it helps with ticket prices, I'll just say, down, keeps them in check. Right now, you know, sometimes they run up a little high and we have to call them and they have to go back. But if you got competition, it keeps those prices where they need to be.
How long was Delta under subsidy from the city?
I believe it was 2 years.
And what did it cost the city?
It didn't cost the city anything. It comes from the federal government.
Essential Air Service, yes. Grant. In other words, the city, underutilized cities could get in a grant from the federal government to pay for the cost of air service into their community.
The U.S.
It was bid, right?
Yes, U.S. DOT bids it out. And we actually, they were the most expensive at the time that it was bid. And we wrote a letter, and I believe the senators even helped us get into Memphis because we told them we wanted to get off EAS. That's nowhere, you know, to be.
And they also chose to get off EAS because they would have had to bid this
again. Yes.
And it has become a profitable run. And had they decided to continue with EAS, they might have lost the bid to somebody else.
When we lost American in 06, they got out of the prop plane business. And the jets, they said they had to fill 40 to 50% to be profitable. And so I always looked at that mark. If we're doing 80, then they're being profitable because they were afraid that Columbia just wouldn't support going into St. Louis, and rightly so.
Which one of the hubs looks the most attractive to our passenger? Or do we know?
It depends. I mean, if you're looking international, you want to either go to O'Hare or maybe even Detroit because they have the most international flights. If you're wanting more, you know, to the west, you need to go to Dallas.
International flights, O'Hare's first, and I think on the list, Dallas is actually second, isn't it?
Yeah, but they don't have as many flights to those as like Detroit does.
And then Atlanta's obviously great. So right. Getting Delta to squeeze, they got a hub in Atlanta.
The one thing about Atlanta is they don't like the 50-seat planes. They want the bigger planes now. They're kind of phasing those out at Atlanta.
From an economic development standpoint, I'd like to ask Mike Brooks how a second airline would help, and I think we've lost some economic development opportunities because of our air service.
Thank you. I think you've probably all heard the message, but I can't tell you that the only reason we were not successful with Project Indigo, which was the animal health company from Spain, but clearly the one factor they did share with us is they had a requirement for a one-hour drive to an airport that provide one-stop service to Barcelona, Spain. So, you know, had we have had that opportunity, then we would have been evaluated on other factors, I'm sure. Unfortunately for us, when they flew into Kansas City. So you've just added another 30 minutes onto the drive to Columbia. Had they have flown into St. Louis, then maybe it would have been within that framework that they would have accepted. But nonetheless, it illustrates the importance of air service. Our data center project, when we did the discussion with our site consultant who assisted us in the process, one of the points that was made is it was a ding against us for our air service. The ability to get product in and out of the community was viewed as a concern, not a overriding concern that says you're off the list or on the list, but a concern.
So in your opinion, would O'Hare have been the answer?
That's an unfair question. I think that what Andrew has talked about makes a lot of sense. As we think about strategies here, one of the really important things I would encourage us to do is understand we have a strong budding relationship with Delta, and we don't want to do anything that's going to harm that relationship. They are the game, and we've got to do everything we can to make sure that that continues to be supported. With that said, my experience flying out of Detroit is very good. And if you step back and say, okay, Delta is your provider, and the international hub that might make logical sense for us, it's either going to be Minneapolis or Detroit. And I think Detroit probably gives us a better shot at the international market. I think the mayor makes a great point about the importance of Dallas-Fort Worth. It would give us, a different avenue by which we can support, the air service. So I think there is a strategy there that says we ought to make sure that Delta is supported. They get through this end of the year and have the opportunity to analyze the effect of the Columbia marketplace, then we can go back and I think we can approach them and talk about, is it an opportunity for us to either add Detroit or can we look at Detroit as opposed to Memphis? I'm not an expert on these things. I would turn to Andrew for that.
Having said that, there is an international flight from Memphis to Amsterdam, which is a big hub in Europe. I mean, you can fly out of Columbia at 4:30, wait an hour and a half in Memphis, and you're on the plane to Amsterdam. And so I think that the opportunity – I think if people understood that, I don't know how many direct locations you need in Europe, but you can get there from Amsterdam. So that's why the Delta relationship is important, as you say.
On another strategy note, I think it's sort of been mentioned, but I just want to stress it. It makes sense to me to go after an international hub before we focus on expanding the terminal in a long-term sense. One, it creates demand throughout the region for flights, and then that it becomes a much easier sell when you need to go to a vote to sell an expansion. So my advice would be, I think the right timing would be let's get that international hub nailed down, and then think about expanding the terminal. And I think what Mike has said is great advice. We may also want to reconvene those that have a stake in this, Jeff City, Overly, the state government, and University of Missouri, certainly, and see if what kind of partnership we might pull together on what the mayor was talking about, a revenue guarantee. And if that's what it takes, we could certainly do that.
Was Was Chris Kelly trying to work on that down in Jeff City? Regional Airport Authority. I don't know if I...
Maybe I should respond to that. I asked Representative Kelly if we had the ability to do an airport authority. I should have looked in the state code myself, but I asked him. And he was kind enough to ask his support team to research that question. And he came back with Section 305 of the state code, which talks about the creation of airport authority. And we do have the ability under current state statute to establish a airport authority, which has the ability to levy taxes. Unfortunately, from my perspective, as we think about a regional entity, if you will, statute only allows for a one county authority. So I emailed or actually text Representative Kelly back and said, can we do a multi-county, after he gave me the information. And the next thing I knew is he said, do you want me to introduce it? I said, sure. You know, let's find out what opportunities there are. So I do think, as we talk about strategies going forward, I think there's a short-term strategy and a long-term strategy. And I think the short-term strategy is what you all talked about. How do we make sure that the service that we have meets, to the best ability that we can get, good service? And whether it's Detroit or an added service, I think we should explore those with every bit of enthusiasm we can generate. And I think Mike is exactly right. We should go down and talk to Jeff City, and we should go over and talk to Fulton, and possibly the folks up in Audrain County. I mean, I think we ought to be talking to the catchment area that Andrew talked about as an opportunity to help build a regional airport. I think the second question is the longer-term strategy, and that is, can we get legislation that would allow for the creation of a multi-county authority? St. Louis has that ability, by the way, but it's very specific in the code to St. Louis. So can we establish an ability to do adjoining counties, if you will, a way to approach an authority that would make it more regional? And if we are interested in exploring that, then it seems to me that it's a building opportunity. So as we talk about how we establish a stronger regional airport, let's look at it from both a short-term perspective, and let's look at it from a longer-term perspective.
Yeah. Thank you.
As you know well, what we essentially have now is a regional asset funded by us. We can't sustain that in the long term, and I couldn't agree more with Mike Brooks. The short term, we can maximize the benefit of this resource we have, but beyond that, beyond adding another flight, another destination, we've pretty well at that point reached the maximum of our infrastructure. At that point, we'll take a regional airport to grow from there.
And Mike, if I can jump in, I just want to. John mentioned something, and I didn't bring it up in the slides. I, in referring to what you're saying about revenue guarantees and attracting, you know, you've got that risk that you put out there to put up the money up front and to attract an airline. I did spend an hour on the phone this morning with Manhattan, the director of the Manhattan, Kansas airport. And if you are familiar with them, they just acquired American Eagle Service into Dallas, and talked to them a little bit. One of the success points that they have there is that they did a 2-year fare guarantee, and they have been so successful. They only utilized that guarantee the first 3 months to get them going. And that was actually more of a glitch on American Eagle's side, because they had priced the tickets so low that the plane was full, but they hadn't reached their yield level. And so when they adjusted the ticket prices, the demand was still there. You know, while we may, if we ever did a fare guarantee, you get all that together. I think that when you look at the population of the areas in our catchment area, that there's your overwhelming demand, especially going west, that you more than likely aren't going to use a lot of that money that you put up front. That's really just the carrot, and you know, after that, it's kind of self-propelled.
Any other questions?
One last comment I'll make. As we move forward in the budget, I really think exposing the airport to a higher level of visibility in the community will be one way to step toward a regional approach. And so I will be talking with you about an idea to make the airport its own department of the city. There are pros and cons to that, and we'll be discussing that in more detail as we move forward. And the pros of it are that it really does become a higher visibility effort of the city.
Session 5, Transportation Funding. John Blattle, Finance Director, will review the sources and uses of the half-cent transportation sales tax. John?
Okay, this is a slide that I had at the mini-retreat in May, and I was asked to represent this slide a little bit more time because we were going pretty quickly how we got to that. What this slide shows is what the half-cent transportation sales tax provides on an annual basis. And you can see that we're projected in fiscal year 12 that it would generate $9.6 million. And as we go forward with a little bit of growth, that gets to approximately $10 million. And currently, how we use that transportation sales tax is we transfer to the general fund for street and sidewalk related purposes almost $5 million. And time you put in a couple of capital projects, it is over $5 million. We put an operating subsidy to transit of $1.4 million, a transfer to transit for capital projects of $215,000. The capital project is usually based on what we need to match federal grants. That's why it's a fairly small number from transportation sales tax, but has huge impact because of the multiplier effect of federal grants. And it's called a subsidy because we would like for our transit, it operates as an enterprise fund, and you would normally like enterprise funds to break even on through their own operations, but the transit does not, and therefore this is considered a subsidy, and that's why that terminology is used. And that's the same thing that happens with the airport. We provide the airport with an operating subsidy from transportation sales tax of 1.1. We also transfer to the airport an amount based on capital projects. And as you'll see, both cases in the airport and in the transit part, we have a large amount of transfer to those two entities in 12 and 13 for capital projects, and that's because we have a fairly defined list of what our capital projects will be for those years and what the expected anticipated federal funding is for those years. In the later years, we do not have it listed as any capital project funding. That's not because we don't anticipate being any. We just do not know what those projects would be at this point. And so that's why it's not projected out. And that's why when you get to the bottom of the slide, the cash balance beginning in 2014 grows significantly each year. It's because we have not identified the capital projects yet.
So another reason to show you this slide again is as we think about the airport and an effort to create a regional asset out of it, regionally funded, there's $2.7 million bottom line for this particular funding source that would be impacted by that change. So if it were funded regionally, that 2.7 would flow into, in this case, potentially streets, which have to mention too much about that 51% again from this morning, or the bus system. So that's another spinoff benefit of regionalization of the airport.
That will take a tough sell. If I'm on the city council and Fulton, and I'm sure they have the same issues we do. I'm going to have to ask you, the city manager, why we're paying for the perception Columbia's airport. Yeah, this $5 million goes to streets and sidewalks. There's more money that goes to streets and sidewalks than another million somewhere?
Yes, sir, there is.
Where does that come from? Regular general fund?
What you're talking about is the special road district tax that we get from the county that flows through from the county, and that goes into streets and sidewalks.
But this is the meat of our street repair fund right here.
Yes, sir.
Let me say, while John and I are trying to work some magic to increase our investment in streets, if we're wildly successful, it will not be very much. to live within our means and meet all of the demands we have, as well as move toward a balanced budget. I shouldn't say that. We are balanced, but move to a budget where we aren't using fund balance to balance. It won't be huge. It won't be doubling this. It'll be far less than that.
There's also a gasoline tax that goes to street and sidewalks, too. So just as another good source of what we put into that. Other questions?
Carol, you can introduce the next.
Session 5, Infrastructure Task Force, highlights and background information. Phoebe Lamar, chair of the Infrastructure Task Force, is here to report on the progress of their task force.
It gives me great pleasure to introduce Phoebe Lamar, who's the chair of the Infrastructure Task Force. She and the task force have been leading the charge since August of 2010 to bring back a report to council at your direction regarding Infrastructure Task Force allocations and how we're doing on that. The supplemental information in your retreat CD are just a sampling of the information and the data that this group has been looking at generating for almost a year, not to mention the amount of speakers, both internal within the city and other speakers that they have invited to come to make presentations to them. So they have an enormous amount of work that they've been challenged with, but they've done a fabulous job, and Phoebe has done a great job in directing them. I'd also like to mention for your information that staff has provided all this information. Some of it has come from members of the task force themselves. We've done it. They have done it without the benefit of any kind of consultant. So while it's not all for free, it's been used with existing resources. Phoebe.
Good afternoon. My name is Phoebe Lamar, and I am the chair of the Infrastructure Task Force. We actually had our first meeting on August 19th of 2010 and have met at least a couple of times a month since that time. I know that we were originally supposed to finish this within 6 months, but unfortunately, it turned out to be a much larger task than we were necessarily anticipating. At the time that the task force was established, our charge was to establish guidelines for determining fair and balanced cost allocations and funding sources among stakeholders and to ensure infrastructure implementation is aligned with the comprehensive growth plan. So we have sought to accomplish that. And have in the process reviewed and obtained an enormous amount of information. Like Paula said, we have spoken with and had people from the city as well as outside people come and talk to us and submit information to us. It has been a daunting task to try to sort through all of the information. We actually are scheduled right now to present our report to you at the July 5th pre-council meeting. So we are nearing the completion of at least a portion of our task. But the what I'm here today to talk to you about is just some of the background information, at least part of it, to present it to you regarding the budget as it stands right now. It sounds like you got some of that information this morning, so I may be repeating things, and if that's the case, I apologize. But let's just start off with one of the tables that was included in your packet that you got before the meeting today, which is the one that's on the screen right now. It talks about the average annual CIP needs versus funding. And you'll see in the second to the last column to the right, the average annual gap. And I'm going to just start by going through all of the areas of infrastructure that at least these are the majority of the areas of infrastructure that we have actually reviewed. I'm going to start by looking at parks and recreation. It shows that there is an annual gap there. What you have to keep in mind in looking at that is that that annual gap reflects if we were to fully fund the entire Trails and Parks Master Plan. So keep in mind, when it looks like there's a gap there, that is only if we decided that it was absolutely the highest priority for us to fully fund that plan. So while it appears to have a pretty substantial annual gap, our conclusion and what we gleaned from meeting with the city, with the director of Parks and Recreation, is that they're really doing pretty well at this point. They can't fully fund the whole plan, but I don't know that it was anticipated that they would be able to fully fund it right now. So they feel like they're really doing pretty good, and they have some direct sources of funding for that. We concluded that we didn't really need to look very much further at Parks and Recreation. Water is actually an enterprise fund. It shows on this particular table that there was actually a little bit of an overage there, which goes with the enterprise fund when you bring in a little more money than you actually use in that given fiscal year. But the fact is, it looks like it's supporting itself pretty effectively. We didn't look a whole lot further as far as water goes. In electric, it's similar to water in that it's an enterprise fund, and it also appears to be supporting itself pretty effectively. On this particular table, it shows an annual gap in funding needs for CIP, but that was also something that was directed to funding the purchase of the CEC. And as a consequence from what we could glean, there's not really any need for additional funding for that particular enterprise fund. We looked at sewer, which is also an enterprise fund. It's our impression that there may be more needs in sewer than there are in water and electric, but we weren't in the best position to be the ones to look at that, given the fact that there's already a sewer task force. There's also the belief that it's probably in better shape than some of the other infrastructure areas, so we didn't make any real recommendations, or will not be, as far as I know, regarding sewer. Stormwater is something that I think we all know is going to be a pretty overwhelming issue at some point in the near future. We are not, however, privy to, and I don't think anybody actually is right now, information that tells us what those needs are actually going to be. We don't know how much is going to be required for the TMDL, so we're not in a good position to make any recommendations. We also know that there is a stormwater task force that is charged with looking at that. And as a result, we aren't making any recommendations, but we are acknowledging up front that we know it's a substantial need and we aren't the best people to address it. So what that left us with is that we believe there's an overwhelming need in the area of streets and sidewalks in the city of Columbia, particularly with regard to streets. If you look at the top row on this particular table, the average annual gap that's shown on this table for CIP projects is almost $14 million, which means that we are underfunding the CIP projects for streets, which includes, from what we could tell, major maintenance to streets, as well as expansion, addition of streets, that sort of thing, by almost $14 million. We believe that this is a substantial need, and we need to figure out some method of addressing it. We may not be able to get even close to $14 million a year, but we need to figure out some ways to increase it. When we took this into account, we believe that the focus for trying to accomplish our mission of determining a fair and balanced allocation of cost and funding sources among the state's stakeholders is with regard to this particular issue. It's important to note also that while I haven't seen the results myself, my understanding from talking to city staff is that in the most recent citizen survey, one of the primary areas of dissatisfaction that was expressed was with regard to the condition of the streets in the city of Columbia. This is further evidence that you all were before your time and you figured it out ahead of time when you appointed this task force. But that doesn't mean that we're done just by appointing the task force. We've got to try and figure out a way to address it as well. Given our concerns with the street infrastructure in Columbia, we started examining where our transportation funds have been going in recent years. I believe you have in your packet a couple of pie charts. The first one is the chart that's up on the screen now, which is the fiscal year 2010 budgeted use of transportation sales tax. This shows, as you can see, that there are funds from the transportation sales tax that are being spread out over a number of different areas, including the airport, including the bus transit subsidies, and those transportation sales taxes are going in a number of different areas. Another chart that you have in your packet that I think is pretty important and which shows even more information than the one that you just saw is the one that's on the bottom of a couple of pages later, which with regard to the fiscal year 2011 uses of dedicated transportation funding. This is more the whole picture. It doesn't include just the transportation sales tax, but includes a number of other areas from which we get transportation funding. But it shows where all of the transportation funding in the city of Columbia is going at this point. As you can see, streets and sidewalks are getting a big chunk, but unfortunately, it still leaves a $14 million deficit, almost $14 million. So we've got to figure out some ways that we can try to address that. The last thing I'm going to show you, which is not something that you have in your packet, is a table that you will be getting, which shows the dedicated transportation funding sources as they are budgeted. And it will give you information regarding how much is being spent on different areas over the last 5 years. One of the things that's difficult in dealing with any of these areas of infrastructure, from what we were able to tell, is that they differ substantially by year based on which projects are being done in any given year. So, for example, one of the things that got earmarked funding at some point in the last few years was the Limone budget, was the Limone Bridge. At that point, there would have been a substantial amount of funding that went directly to that because that's what it was earmarked for. So you have to look at patterns more so than you do at just any given year on trying to determine how the funding is being done. You will be getting information that shows more of the trend as opposed to just a given year. I didn't have a pie chart to show you that shows the five-year budgeted uses, but you will at some point be getting that. We need to look at the trends, and then we've got to figure out some ways to do that. Part of what we're going to be trying to do when we make our presentation in about, I think it's 3 weeks, maybe four, is we're going to be trying to give you some of our ideas. I'm sure you guys will have ideas as well, and they may be better than ours, but the fact is we've been racking our brains trying to figure out ideas for where we can get some additional funding and how we can structure it so there will be additional funding to address what appears to be a very substantial need in the city of Columbia. I'm happy to answer any questions, or if you all have any suggestions of things you'd like us to include, please feel free to let me know.
Ms. Lamar, thank you. This is an overwhelming amount of information that you've collected. My question is, I'm just wondering if you, in your research, have your committee's research, looked at other comparable cities to see how it is they're funding their transportation needs.
The city staff was really good about collecting information from a number of different places. It's difficult to determine what is actually a comparable city because, for example, we've looked at Big 12 cities. We have tried to look at other cities in the state of Missouri. We have looked at information from other areas, and we've gleaned it in a number of different ways as far as methods of funding, as far as, you know, what they spend on different things. So I guess I would need more specifics, and frankly, I don't know the numbers off the top of my head, so I'm sorry. But I guess I would need more specifics to know what it is you're wanting to know. But in fact, yes, we have looked at information from different places.
Mike, will the ICMA data help?
It can. It does have a roads and highways section, and it can compare what each city spends per mile to repave, and not only new construction, but repair and maintenance of current roads. So it's another way that would help us.
I don't want to make a big issue about this, but I think when you look at City of Columbia average annual CIP needs versus funding, you know, slide there, you know, it's probably not helpful to put the wish list, mixing wish lists with needs. And not to be critical of Parks and Rec, they're well-funded, and the citizens came up big with the parks tax. But you know, we're not going to do $7 million a year for parks. It's just really that doesn't even help to put that on the list. And then I would say for the stormwater needs, we haven't identified what they are, but, you know, let's tell us what it is. I mean, you wanted $5 million a year. I presume that's what you think we need, and we ought to have a list of what goes into that $5 million. I think you sort of addressed that with the consultant's report, but, you know, whenever we look at, if we're going to go to the voters and ask for revenue enhancements or taxes or user fees or whatever for infrastructure, this is what we're going to be working on. This plus the citizen satisfaction results, which obviously overwhelmingly talk about streets and sidewalks. So we need to put that up against this and have real numbers, because stormwater is expensive. It's a matter of, can we afford to go to the public asking for a robust stormwater fee increase and not a comparable increase in streets and sidewalks? I know that city manager is going to deal with that later today, perhaps, tomorrow.
Are you going to make great part about the retreat is we're talking about these big ideas, right? And
yeah,
we will deal with them. You know, one opportunity, of course, is they're so integrally linked. The stormwater is usually under the road or next to it. Sidewalks are right next to that, sometimes on top. There might be some value, and it's all infrastructure. It all needs to be repaired, rebuilt. There might be some value in just treating them all at the same time,
right,
with some kind of capital investment.
The other thing about the CIP is it's sort of a wish list, but it's also a list of a lot of things that are in various master plans, so that, and then the Parks and Rec can be opportunistic, as can the other departments as needs arise. So, for example, when the Getabout money came along, Parks and Rec was able to pick off, and so was Public Works, pick off some things out of the CIP that had no funding and suddenly did. But yeah, this chart here is kind of, we know from the other presentation, the $5 million a year or whatever, there was a specific list of projects there, and I actually don't even remember if those are all in the CIP or not. I'm getting a nod, so.
And then it begs the question, though, is there a wish list in the street and sidewalks?
Well, there.
I suspect there's less of it. I know that we've got $140 million we'd like to have for East Columbia, right, with 740. A lot of that is predicated on flow-through money from the state and flow-through money from the federal government, which
and
we don't have
future
control
growth and.
And how much does that play into this? I mean, obviously there are three sources of funding. One is what we can achieve locally, through our capital improvements tax, mm-hmm. transportation tax, our general fund transfers,
mm-hmm.
MoDOT, and then the federal government.
MoDOT's and having its own.
I don't think anybody's optimistic about MoDOT or the federal government, which creates more of a challenge.
Right.
Yes.
Now,
can I just point out one thing with regard to the question that you just asked, as far as the wish list versus, you know, what are actual needs? At least as it relates to streets and sidewalks, from what I was able to glean from the information that we got, there may be what you could call a wish list if you start looking several years out. If you start looking at the 6 to 10 year range, that may be parts of it, may be on the wish list. But the reality is that the way that I could glean it from what we were given is that really it's not so much a wish list as it is that the projects that need to be done but they can't afford to do it right now are getting put on the 6 to 10 years because they don't know where else to put them.
Mm-hmm.
So, and if you look actually at the 1 to 2 years list, you're looking at, you've got $48 million worth of projects that are on the 1 to 2 year needs. You've got a budget from 2011 of 12,715, 12,715. You've got an average annual gap shown of 13,828. But in fact, I believe that when you do the math on that, you actually end up with a more substantial gap in the 1 to 2 year needs category than just that 13,828. You actually end up with an increase in that 1 to 2 year needs from my very brief doing of the math of that this morning. And keep in mind, I'm a lawyer, I'm not a mathematician. So, but I mean, just doing it briefly this morning, I believe you actually have more of a gap in that 1 to 2 year category than you do on that average annual gap. So to try to say that as far as streets and sidewalks go, I don't think it's a wish list. I think it's a need. I think it's a necessity. It's just we can't figure out how to pay for it.
Well, it's a need in the sense of the roads may not be adequate, but the earth is still going to be turning and we're still going to be driving on those roads because we don't have that money. What I'm hoping is somebody, John, or somebody else, around 2005, there was a study that listed a $50 million road gap, which might be another way of saying exactly what you're saying. Does anybody remember that study?
Yes, that was the 2005 Finance Transportation Advisory Committee. In fact, this task force has built on, they used it as a main jumping off point, so to speak. So they did read that, they'd studied it. It's one of the many resources that they uh-huh. use. But they did start from that and use that as kind of a starting point.
I'm going to guess, see, this $13 million per year gap is probably another way of saying $50 million, I'm going to guess. Because then you get into the 6 to 10 years.
I don't know about that. The $13 million gap is based on the CIP plan as it stands right now under finance, and I don't know how
If I'm hearing you right, you're saying it could be bigger than that, but
I think what you can say is that similar issue to what you're faced with now is what was recognized by the committee in 2005. And Mr. Scala is sitting here, and he was on the committee at that time.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I see him.
And also in this task force.
Mm-hmm.
I think another way to look at the magnitude of this gap is that if we were to determine we must ask the citizens for this source of revenue, that the streets and sidewalks is a 3/4% sales tax to get to that amount of money, and the stormwater is another quarter. So these needs translate into basically a 1% increase in sales tax to meet what we are being told are the needs, and that's
a big bill.
That would be a huge challenge. That it'd be interesting to see what the will of the citizens would be to fund those requests.
May I just ask, following up on that? I mean, talking just sales tax, I'm just wondering whether the committee also looked at the. Whether our current development charges are fair and reasonable, because was a subject matter of the 2005.
That was actually the biggest part of what we were looking at until we were about 4 months into this, maybe 5 months, and then we decided that we really needed to expand it beyond that. And the majority of the committee, frankly, doesn't think that development charges is the best method of trying to increase the amount of funding that's coming in. The fact is, we are very concerned that, I mean, we can tell you where the dollars have come from. We can show you where they've increased. We can also show you where there's been a substantial decrease in development, and as a result, there's been a decrease in the money that's coming in. But unfortunately, if you start increasing those fees, you only decrease the ability to do affordable housing, and you also potentially put a crimp on further development. And whether that, I mean, if that's what the City of Columbia decides we want to do, that's our choice. But our concern is that we would be, in fact, impinging on development, which at least the majority of the people in our group are not convinced is a good idea.
This would be a perfect area where I'd like to know what was being done in other cities. You know, just to see, again, to see what the benchmark is and to see where whether I'm not saying it should be at all. I do not believe that the developer should bear this. You know, it may be a mix of things. All I want to know is whether the charges that we are charging, are they fair and reasonable and comparable with
we
other
have,
cities?
We have compared that.
Right.
From a magnitude standpoint, once again, it would be useful to have the information that Helen asked for, but we're getting right now about $750,000 a year from developers, even after having increased them. Even if you chose to double them, you know,
it doesn't really put a drop in the
bucket. We're still $20 million short. I mean, you could double development fees, appears to me, and have virtually no impact on the substantial needs that have been identified.
Staff did an earlier, one of the first reports that we did is I work with all of the Big 12 schools and I work with their finance departments, and I looked at all of their budgets, all their CIPs, to take a look at what all their funding sources was for transportation. And I can tell you that there was no one that was similar to the other. It was just a variety and a mixture of funding sources of how they fund their transportation. Everything from an additional gasoline tax to a vehicle tax to a bicycle tax, different kinds of taxes that were actually very interesting, but it was daunting. So we can go back. I'll visit with the chair and the commission the staff for us a little bit more and see what we can do as far as pulling out some specific benchmark cities, but they
but
were
we
all different.
We got 6 for maintenance and 9 for capital improvements. It'd be not be interesting to know what, and you could divide that by 100,000, come up with a per capita number. I mean, how does that rank? I mean, are we shortchanging our streets and sidewalks? Are we funding them generously? I mean, I don't know the answer to that question. I think the conventional wisdom is that we're not funding this infrastructure very well, but it'd be nice to validate that.
Well, and part of what we're dealing with when we start trying to compare it to other cities in trying to do an analysis of that is you start trying to compare to cities that are not the same climate as we are, and as a result their streets wear differently than ours do. And so while we can compare to other cities, the reality is on a lot of levels you're comparing apples to oranges. And that was the other thing that we found in trying to compare our development fees to those in other cities, is that frequently we were comparing an apple here to an orange there to really it was a banana over here. I mean, you can compare them, but the reality is you can't compare them equally because they're not the same. I mean, we charge one thing, they charge something different, and this city over here charges something entirely different. And you can look at them and you can say, okay, well, you're getting money from something, but whether they are the same thing, frequently they are not. But that doesn't mean that we can just add the fees that are being charged in City A and City B to the fees that we're already charging in City C, because then you put them into a realm that it's not feasible financially to build a house or whatever.
But we as staff, we can take a look.
You can look at how much is being spent, though, and then backtrack to figure out the source of funds for that.
Sure.
And, you know, getting back to the Champaign, Iowa City, I mean, they're even Des Moines. A little further north, a little more snow, but still, I know it's not Austin, Texas, and it's not Gainesville, Florida, but those are in the same temperate band we're in, so you probably can use some of that for comparison.
I'll take another plug for CPM, ICMA. They do that very thing nationwide, and they do a great job of helping cities do the analysis, and they do pull out the same climate, especially when it affects roads, because it's so dependent on freeze-thaw and winter conditions. And they do calculate expenditures per mile. So it's best apples-to-apples comparison that I've ever seen.
I have one question. You know, hopefully the economy will get better, continue to get better. Are you looking at projections of what we will take in for sales tax as the economy improves and figuring that into how we can meet our needs and lowering the amount we would have to ask for additional sales tax?
Absolutely. It's a large part of our calculus as we prep the budget. Our first goal is to close the gap between what we spend and what comes in. We're still negative there, but we won't close it all in 1 year just because we believe in the fact that it's getting better, and hopefully it'll pull us out of that partly. We're going to have to shave some spending just to get to equilibrium. But then we reach a point where every efficiency we can find helps us reach that goal without a tax increase. So I think the mayor has said it many times, you know, what have you done for me lately, right? You know, what savings can we see through new technology? And I'll just point one. I know John's working on automated collection of solid waste that has proven over and over again throughout the country to, over time, almost cut the cost in half to collect trash. Well, what do we do with that money then once we save it? So that's the great opportunity to push more into rebuilding the infrastructure we have. It's, of course, rules allow that. So we have a lot of calculus to do, but the short answer is yes.
And I'll point out one other dynamic again, which people are tired of talking about, but we need to talk about, and that's the unfunded liabilities. We paid $1.5 million in the pension plans in 10 years ago. We wrote out a check for $6 million last year, and the gap is widening. That's $6 million out of the general fund, out of the $75 million. I mean, think about what that amount of money means to infrastructure. You take $4.5 million there, you're giving salary increases to staff. You are funding streets. I mean, that is an enormous amount of money that we've got your hands tied behind your back on the budget, because that number is probably going to go up. That's the challenge that you have. Welcome to Columbia.
It's an excellent reminder, and I look forward to that task force. It's nearly complete its work.
I think they may get delayed into July just because of some out-of-town deals within the month.
And that is a giant issue we have to deal with, and we will do it. It may take a couple of years, 3 years, to find the total solution. But I think there are steps we can take early, and we'll do that together. I will work with employees and representative groups to find the least painful ways to address that issue, and we'll come back to council with a menu of options and have you make the hard decisions. I'll say this: we cannot afford to continue the path we're on.
Yeah, certainly even if it stayed at that rate, let alone kept increasing, that would be a serious issue. Another thing I wonder if the Comprehensive Plan Task Force is looking at is, are there ways to plan for growth where are less miles of new road for the number of people, if we can plan more intelligently? Because that, I think what we're discovering is there isn't enough money in the world to build all the roads that we have in the CIP, and so therefore, what are we going to do? And what I do in my business is if I say, well, I need all these things, but I don't have the money for them, is I spread them out. And you know, or in this case, what we might do is figure out a way to not need all those roads.
Excellent approach.
Because we're going to have to come back to the, we're going to have to do something about the unfunded pension liability, and I don't know that we should forget about the health care reform either, which I think that was another big unknown number that we don't have for 3 years from now. And then, you know, if we really have this road need, we ought to figure out some way to not need all these roads. And the other thing, too, that I have a question about is I'm not really clear from looking at the numbers that we're looking here. How much of this is maintenance for what we have versus building new roads? Because we do need new roads, but we also need to maintain what we have. Or if there's stuff we are maintaining that we don't need, maybe we should stop. Youngstown, Ohio is a city that they have a different problem. They have declining population, but they take roads out of service when it isn't economic to keep them up.
Isn't it $6 million for maintenance and $9 million for capital improvements?
If you look at the fiscal year 2010 budgeted use transportation sales tax, the $6,042,000 on that was for maintenance-type projects. There was only $150,000 in that was designed for capital improvement projects. That is not the whole transportation tax, and I don't have those numbers for 2010. And the 2011 does not split out the capital improvements versus maintenance. So I don't know what the split is in the 2011 budget.
To some extent, it's semantics. So when we have one of these storm sewer failures and you have to rebuild a street, is that a capital improvement or is that maintenance? You know,
it's difficult to determine that.
Yeah.
You know,
your point is building new streets versus fixing the ones we have.
Yeah,
and we don't. I don't think we track it that specifically. We certainly know which is which, and we can calculate.
Yeah, we couldn't have an exact number, but we get some idea so that we know. Okay, well, if we build new roads, how much is that going to add to our maintenance costs? Just rule of thumb, kind of thing.
We've danced around so many numbers and figures that I know we have the maintenance though that break out in another chart. It's just not with us today, but I know we've got it.
We know we have it, and so we'll.
And make sure that it's included or at least a recommendation to them that they include it in their report.
Go back to the slide that has average funding over past 10 years.
This one?
No, it's got.
This one? Over the last 5 years?
No, that's not the slide.
I may not have it on the slide. Sorry.
It's actually at the bottom of the page that has the average CIP needs versus funding.
Oh, the
yeah, and the only reason to say that it's got the capital funding sources and $9 million, you know, well, 1.1 of that's non-motorized grant, which is going away. You know, we've got federal STP money, we've got MoDOT, both of which are shrinking rather than growing. We've got CDBG, which is going to be shrinking rather than growing. Not to be overly pessimistic, but some of the major sources of funding for capital improvements in streets and sidewalks are going south on us.
That's correct.
I can say, once again, as being fairly new to the community, Providence has some issues as a street, and of course that's a state road, so it's a perfect, you know, real-world example of how do you fix that if MoDOT isn't going to?
And I suspect when people voted on their dissatisfaction with roads, a lot more of them are driving Providence Road than, you know, Fifth Street.
Excellent point. You know, we all have our neighborhood street, but we all use Providence and Stadium and Broadway. Yeah. So there's arterials that mean a lot. Many of them aren't maintained by the city, and I think the average person doesn't keep track of which roads are whose, so it is definitely mixed in there.
But we could have a clear map on the website that says city roads, MoDOT roads, so people can see.
With the phone number?
Yeah, with a phone number.
Not a bad idea.
So it's perhaps our job to explain to the public if the tax, you know, we have two things. They may not vote for the tax that would fund this, and they want the roads that the tax would fund. And it would be our job then to explain to them, explain to people that if we don't want to raise taxes, that we can learn to, we'll have to learn to live more frugally and accept a certain lower standard of road quality or fewer roads, more traffic delays. But we're not doing this public a service by saying we're going to fix all these problems and then not, and then if the, you know, not explain the tax that's necessary to do that. We can't be magic. We can't make the money come from nowhere.
You know, one of the interesting, the question, really part of their whole charge, and they grappled with this for a long time, was to examine the cost allocation for infrastructure spending and is it fair and equitable in the community. How long did you grapple with that question? Long time before they really, I'm not sure that you really completely have come to grips with it, but it was a fundamental question and the fundamental language of their charge, and that includes not just the developer in the city, but MoDOT and anybody else that's involved in infrastructure planning and funding for the community.
Unfortunately, there's just a substantial portion of it that we have zero ability to change, like MoDOT.
Just in summary, from what I took away from the survey is that the public wants us to pay attention to maintenance first and foremost. New roads would be secondary to that. So I think that has to be our focus, our first focus.
Is it not true, though, that new roads basically require ODOT funding? And I mean, 740 is not going to be funded by our transportation tax.
You talking
about an overstatement?
To the east or the one over by the mall?
The east. I know how the one over by the mall is being funded by a variety.
Correct.
The east
state. $40 million.
Right.
$140
million. Probably not even reflected in this.
No, it's not. The other thing I'll say is you talked about the non-motorized and that funding going away. Well, everything we built with that funding will need maintenance.
Rest yet?
On this? Well, I think the ICMA data is going to be interesting because there are going to be trends there, too. I mean,
that's right.
I think Columbia is challenging but stable. But, I mean, there are some real debacles out there in the city finances and state finances. And you don't want to use that as an excuse, but it just points out the challenge that we face. And I think the citizens, you know, deserve to know that, too.
Absolutely. We need to approach this year with our eyes open. We know what the issues are. And the great thing about ICMA and having that knowledge, what you're going to find is we're not the only one in this soup, you know. And, in fact, Columbia is doing a remarkable job on a number of things.
I just have one quick follow-up question, probably for John. But are we in worse shape in terms of the maintenance of our street because we've deferred the maintenance because we haven't been able to afford it? Or I just want to get a good picture of where are we in worse shape because we haven't been maintaining our streets because we couldn't afford it? Or I mean, if we get them back up to shape into shape and pay more attention to maintaining what we have, would there be cost savings going forward? I guess that's my question.
Well, there's always a. If you build a new street, it's as good as it gets the first day you open it. And even if you don't drive on it, it deteriorates. And so you got this curve. And the farther you get down this curve, the more it costs to get it back up. So if you maintain it when it's new and continually keep it good, it's a lot less expensive than wait until it completely fails and then try to get it back. And some of our streets, and I'll just use some of the concrete ones we built back in the 60s, like over on Garth and those places that are very rough, need to be replaced. One of them we overlaid last year was Rogers in front of Columbia College there because we did the street, so it's a lot better shape. But it doesn't go a long way, and so our funding, as the mayor points out, you know, we've we don't have a lot of money to go toward maintenance, and so we concentrate on the major routes, which you'll see, you know, is in good shape, but the neighborhood streets we have deferred.
Another thing that we became aware of as we were working with this is that while there have we have increased the transportation sales tax in the last 20 years, 25 years, we have continued to get capital improvements taxes. We have found other ways of paying for street maintenance and for additional streets, those sorts of things. But the fact is, the amount of general revenue that has gone to street maintenance, et cetera, has decreased pretty substantially in the last 10 to 15 years. Since the point that the transportation sales tax went into effect, there has been I can't verify all the numbers, but I can tell you that the amount that has come out of general revenue has decreased substantially as far as trying to pay for street maintenance, et cetera. So while we have found additional methods of funding, we have not continued to fund it with the ways that it was being funded before, which means that the amount of dollars that's being spent on it has also, at least during some years, decreased substantially. So.
And yet, using that as a source of funds, I think realistically that's not going to happen. You know, we got $19 million from sales tax, right? Something like that. 5% increase in sales tax revenue is still less than $1 million.
We are not focusing on general revenue.
I'm just pointing out
I agree.
But the cities who are forced to who run into general fund problems balance their budget by laying off police officers and firefighters. That's what it comes down to. And what's challenging is that we've got a commitment. We've had a commitment of $900,000 a year to social services, which we haven't increased, but we've maintained that commitment of the general fund. Plus, I think in the care funded through Parks and Rec out of the general fund, it's another five. So that's $1.4 million in social services that we have a long tradition of funding. And we've got police needs, obviously, and fire needs. So it's probably not realistic to see the availability of transfers from the general fund for this.
Nothing that will be remarkable. Again, we're working to try to reflect what was clearly the community has said in the survey and what all of you have been mentioning to staff over time. We will work to meet every need, but in this economy, it will not be an overwhelming change overnight. It'll be a long, slow pressure against a tough boulder to move. But we can improve things over time. It'll just be baby steps. It's a bit like starting a flywheel, I guess. Give it enough pressure over long enough term, and it begins to have an effect and take on a momentum of its own. That's the effort we're engaged in at this point.
Right. The point that John made about the maintenance is the same points that Bob made about the unfunded pension liability, that the sooner we fix them, the less painful it's going to be, even though it hurts a lot now. And I think if I'm probably unnecessarily repeating your words, but if we explain to people that that is going to take a long time to turn that flywheel and that it's not a disaster and it's not going to be a disaster as long as we keep our expectations modest and, what should we say, a healthy sense of pessimism of how long it's going to take.
In a period of earmarks not being popular right now, which we heard when we were out in D.C., as the mayor recalls, we are keeping our high priority, larger cost highway projects on the top of our federal project list. And as Congress, when Congress gets around to taking up the reauthorization of the Federal Highway Authorization Bill, we will do our best to try to get what earmarks we can for those projects for Columbia.
And that's where CIP and master plans are handy, is that we have our list ready of what we need when they're available. The Wall Street Journal had an interesting article about earmarks, and that is that while they're extremely unpopular right now, the argument for earmarks was that it gave control of which projects were selected. It gave control of some control of projects to the people through the legislature instead of through bureaucracy. So that was the argument for earmarks. But of course, one man's earmark is another man's boondoggle. So they're unpopular now, and here we are.
Not to simply talk about problems that we have all day, there are techniques that can help. And beyond the technique of asking for more and the technique of becoming more efficient and moving the money we already have to the things we want to focus on, we can operate slightly differently. And by that, I mean one successful technique has been throughout the country focusing the amount of money we have on a smaller geographic area. And so rather than try to cover the entire city and do a little bit in each neighborhood, you might prioritize, and then the tough part is the discipline to stick to this list, right? And prioritize, and then what you're actually doing is focusing more of your resource in a smaller area, but you have such a big impact that everybody can see it, and they feel the difference. Sometimes satisfaction rates go up, but you can actually make a bigger impact, sort of almost one neighborhood at a time, you might say. So that's a technique we'll be exploring. It certainly will be your decision if we move that direction, and I just offer that up to give us some hope that there are things we can do to improve the situation.
Sort of in the open discussion period, and we have been for 20 minutes or
transition
so.
Right.
Phoebe Lamar may or may not want to stick around with us. Thank you for your presentation.
Thanks.
It was
sure.
Very good. Any discussion?
I have just a question or a point. In past retreats, in the mini retreat, we spent a little more time on the CIP and having an opportunity to ask questions about that, make suggestions for additions or subtractions. So when, if not now, would be a good time to do that?
I guess the thought that leaps to mind is maybe pre-council session we could devote to that topic, if that would be useful.
That would be great.
Maybe some sort of an update on the current CIPs for the new people on the council, so they can kind of see what's in their particular area or their wards.
And I think it would be useful to divide it out by ward.
Especially, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Just out of interest, everyone here, could you raise your hand if this is your first retreat? I know it's mine. I think that's interesting.
I think let me just compliment the staff on putting together. I found this very informative and very helpful. And I thought the survey was extremely enlightening. It just points out that you can have impressions, and it's nice to know if to either validate your impressions, or if their impressions are wrong, you need to sort through and rejigger your thought process. But I think the fact that we came out of that citizen survey with people concerned about I guess streets and public safety, which I think thematically you sort of suspected that's what's on most people's minds, but it certainly was validated. And I thought it was helpful to me.
Certainly gives us a clear picture. picture of the intensity of that feeling as well.
I'd like to mention something. I know that my predecessor, Laura Nowser, spoke eloquently and frequently about the fact that she had been concerned that there wasn't enough goal setting done by the city council. I know that she had attended quite a few league conferences at cities and had thought that was something that we were lacking. I have not given it a lot of thought, but I know that was one of her concerns going forward. Certainly, you know, being one of a longer standing city council person, she mentioned it again when she left, and I'm just wondering if there's something missing, whether we should be doing, rather than reacting to everything we have to react to on a day-to-day basis, if it's something that we should be thinking about some goal setting.
That's a great idea. In fact, I feel that want on the staff side too. That for me, that comes out in words like strategic plan. You know, what do we want to do? Where are we going? The vision committee's done a great job to try to say, you know, go that way. You know, and so our challenge is, okay, let's plot that course. You're driving the ship, so it makes excellent sense to touch base on that and to do some goal setting. There are 100 ways to do that well. So perhaps what I could do is throw out some ideas at over, see what you like, which approach you'd like to take. Certainly can do that.
Any other comments?
Your message.
Like finish a little early?
That's success. That's the sure sign of a successful retreat if you can get out early. Tomorrow should be a little more fun, a little less depressing, and we'll. No promises, right?